morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We are broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And the show is archived now several months back, so... And you can also listen to the show on iTunes. Don't forget, we are at 101.1 FM now. If you haven't retuned your radio dials, please do so. I'd like to welcome Gerald Horn joining us by telephone. He's professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston. He's the author of many books, and we've actually interviewed Gerald Horn on a number of them before. His latest two books, which we're going to be talking about today, are the first is The Deepest South, The United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade, and the second is White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas After the Civil War. Welcome, Gerald Horn, to the Radio Cafe. It's great to have you back.
Well, it's great to be here. It's always a pleasure.
Let's first talk about the book, The Deepest South. And between 1500 and 1800, as you write in your book, more Africans than Europeans came to the Americas. Where in the Americas did the slave trade begin, or did it happen everywhere pretty much at the same time?
Well, I guess it's fair to say that the African slave trade basically began in the Caribbean, but it quickly spread to South America, with Brazil being the largest recipient of Africans in this hemisphere. Brazil has a larger population of African descent than any other nation on this planet outside of Nigeria. But of course, as we well know, the slave trade also spread to North America, and the United States, as of today, has an African-derived population of about 40 million. Brazil's African-derived population may be twice as much, and that's a conservative estimate. Now, what's interesting about the African slave trade to Brazil is the role played by U.S. nationals, U.S. citizens. What's also striking is that the African slave trade was probably at its height just before it collapsed. That is to say that Brazilian slavery lasted until 1888. U.S. slavery, as you know, lasted till roughly 1863, 1865. But the African slave trade, that is to say the process of dragging Africans across the Atlantic, basically was at its height in the 1840s and the 1850s. And there hangs the tale, because you may know that we're marking in this year, 2007, the 200th anniversary of Britain's move to abolish the transatlantic slave trade. You might recall the film that came across the Atlantic a few months ago, Amazing Grace, starring the African singer Yusu Endur, among others, which basically dramatizes this story. After, and you might also know, of course, that you're having all kinds of commemorations in the UK involving everyone from Queen Elizabeth to the Prime Minister. And you might also want to ask yourself why we're not having a similar commemoration on this side of the Atlantic, given that it was approximately 200 years ago in this country as well that decisive steps were taken, allegedly, to abolish the transatlantic slave trade. Britain moved in the 1830s to abolish slavery itself, well before the United States and Brazil. And then after moving to abolish slavery in its empire, in Jamaica, Trinidad, Barbados, etc., Britain did not want other nations to have an advantage over it in terms of producing commodities like sugar and cotton and coffee with slave labor. So it set up something of a maritime picket line alongst the west coast of Africa to prevent U.S. flag ships, for example, from coming into West Africa and taking away Africans across the Atlantic. But U.S. nationals, quite frankly, managed to outsmart the British on more than one occasion. And as a result, tens of thousands of Africans came across the Atlantic in the 1840s and in the 1850s in particular, flooding Brazil and to a certain extent Cuba with Africans. And of course, this led to very sharp conflicts between London and Washington. And it also led, I should add, to a certain amount of sympathy for London on behalf of African Americans in this country, as opposed to sympathy for their own government, which basically turned a blind eye to the inhumanity and the brutality of the African slave trade during the time when it was reaching its zenith.
I think it's really important to point out that after the slave trade was abolished in the United States, as you're saying, an illicit slave trade flourished. And it's sort of hard to imagine how that happened, given that the trade of human beings is hardly an invisible, it's not like diamonds or something that you can put in your in a small pocket or something like that. I mean, how in the world did they do it?
Well, keep in mind that there was something of a jaded, blasé attitude to slavery and the slave trade. Many people found a rationale for slavery and the slave trade in the Bible, in the Christian Bible. Keep in mind as well that slavery itself was a socioeconomic system, not, well, akin to, say, capitalism being a socioeconomic system or feudalism being a socioeconomic system or socialism being a socioeconomic system. And as a result, you have a situation where virtually every racial and ethnic group on this planet, its ancestors, have endured slavery of one kind or another. And in fact, even if you set aside that particular point, you should also keep in mind that in the early part of the 19th century, one of the central conflicts between the United States and the Arab countries in northern Africa, particularly in northwestern Africa and present-day Algeria, was the fact that along this so-called Barbary Coast, as it was called on this side of the Atlantic, there was a thriving trade in capturing U.S. nationals and other Europeans and then transporting them to the slave markets of the Ottoman Empire, that is to say what we would now call present-day Turkey. So slavery in and of itself was not necessarily viewed with the kind of distaste that it is viewed today. The difference, of course, between these kinds of slavery, slavery as a socioeconomic system, and slavery as it existed in the 1840s and the 1850s in Brazil and in the United States, was that this was a racial slavery. It was a slavery that basically marked those who either were of African ancestry or who were thought to be of African ancestry. I have to add that second qualifier, because, as you know, in the United States, we have the so-called one-drop rule, where you can look like Arnold Schwarzenegger or George Bush, but if you have the faintest hint of African ancestry in your family tree, you're considered to be black, so-called light-skinned Negroes, as they're called in this country. And so as a result, another thriving trade developed as a result of this kind of social construct. That is to say, you, Mary Charlotte, some slave trader might say, you say you're not black, but you know, we know better, so they'll throw you into the ship, and next thing you know, you're working on a plantation in Brazil. So the kind of jaded attitude that led to this kind of behavior helped to propel the African slave trade. And, of course, the United States was a major country. That is to say, it had a major shipbuilding industry. Even when U.S. flag ships were not taking Africans from Africa across the Atlantic, you had U.S.-built ships that were doing the same thing, perhaps sailing under the Brazilian flag or the Spanish flag or the Portuguese flag, which, of course, these were other major slave-trading nations. I should also add that the U.S. flag ships were able to foil the British, the Royal Navy, by going to a different part of Africa. That is to say, the Royal Navy basically set up alongst the west coast of Africa, alongst the bulge of Africa, sticking out into the Atlantic in, say, present-day Senegal, stretching down to southwest Africa in, say, present-day Angola. But what happened is that just as if you have drug dealers in one neighborhood in Santa Fe and the police clamp down there, the drug dealers are moved to another neighborhood. Well, that's basically what the slave dealers and the slave traders did. They moved around the southern tip of Africa, the African continent, to Southeast Africa, to East Africa. And one of the things I point out in this book is that we've underestimated the number of Africans who have roots in Eastern Africa. We automatically assume that most African Americans, for example, have West African roots, and most Afro-Brazilians have West African roots. The fact is that if you look at the island of Zanzibar, which is off the southeastern coast of the African continent and is part of present-day Tanzania, this was a major slave trading entrepot. This was a major slave trading site even before the transatlantic slave trade, during the bad old days of the so-called Arab slave trade, which of course predated the Atlantic slave trade and of course continued after the Atlantic slave trade. Well, what's interesting is that as early as the 1840s, you had U.S. nationals who were the major economic force in Zanzibar, this major slave trading site. And this also became the site from whence many Africans were taken and then dragged across the Atlantic to either Brazil or Cuba or North America.
We're talking to Professor Gerald Horn. Let me ask you a question. I've never understood this. Your book shed some light on this. How did slave traders actually get the people from Africa? How did they kidnap them? What means did they use to capture human beings who surely did not want to get on any ship?
Well, keep in mind that there was a certain amount of antagonism between different ethnic groups in Africa, just like you have antagonism in Europe between Serbs and Croats and Russians and Poles and English and Irish, and how from time to time this leads to wars and conflicts, be it the long-standing war in Northern Ireland, which has been going on for centuries, or the wars in the Balkans, which, of course, were a staple of newscasts in the 1990s. And you have the same kinds of conflicts in Africa, and so what happens is that those who were taken prisoner, if you're on the losing side of a war, you're basically disposed of. And that's basically the source of many of the Africans who were dragged across the Atlantic. And then, of course, keep in mind that slave trading was a highly profitable business. In the 1850s, for example, just before slavery collapses in this country, by means mostly foul, you could buy an African in Congo, for example, for less than $10. But if that African had certain skills and was of a certain age, you could sell that African on this side of the Atlantic for $500, $1,000. I mean, think of the amazing profit that's involved. And when you have that kind of profit, people will find a way to accomplish the deed, to accomplish the task. And that basically sums up how and why it was so relatively simple to buy Africans and drag them across the Atlantic. Now, what's interesting about this African slave trade as well is that even though U.S. nationals played the pivotal role during the 1840s and the 1850s when it was illegal, in the 1840s, you had a number of Virginians who were hotly opposed to this illegal trade, even though they were pro-slavery. In the book, I talk at length about Henry Wise, who was U.S. ambassador to Brazil in the 1840s when Africans were flooding across the Atlantic. Your listeners may know Henry Wise as the Virginia governor who presided over the execution of John Brown. John Brown was the white man from Kansas who was so upset by African slavery on these shores that he tried to lead a bloody revolt against this peculiar institution in 1859, and of course was captured by the soon-to-be Confederate General Robert E. Lee, and was executed. And the execution was presided over by Henry Wise. Now, you might think that Henry Wise would be pro-illicit African slave trade, but the fact was that he was not. And why is this, you ask? Well, for the longest, Virginia had developed a rather profitable industry of, quote, breeding, unquote, Africans, just like you would breed livestock, and selling them down the river, whereby they could develop Mississippi, Alabama, for example, the states of the Deep South. Well, many Virginians had developed the idea that these Africans from Virginia should be sold all the way down the river to Brazil, where they could develop the Amazon. And therefore, there would be no need to go into Africa, to go into Congo, Angola, Zanzibar, and take Africans from there and drag them across the Atlantic. In fact, some Virginians had developed the idea that the United States should seize the Amazon, just like the United States in the war against Mexico, 1846 and 1848, had seized a good deal of Mexican soil, Mexican territory, including, if I'm not mistaken, the soil on which you are presently sitting. And as a result of this, it was interesting that there was an article in the New York Times just a few days ago about Brazilian paranoia about the United States' designs on the Amazon. And the New York Times reporter just thought this was lunacy. I mean, nobody in the United States has this idea. But, of course, like a lot of contemporary journalism, he had basically aborted history. I mean, many Brazilians have not forgotten these ideas that many Southerners in the United States had about seizing the Amazon and then stocking the Amazon with enslaved Virginians so that this territory could be not only developed, but developed under the U.S. flag.
We're talking to Gerald Horn. Your book, The Deepest South, the United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade, brings up something about which I'd had no idea, namely the alliance between the Confederate South and Brazil. And in fact, when the South, which had fewer people and less money than the industrial North, seceded from the Union, they were counting on an alliance with Brazil. Tell us about the development of this alliance and how it finally panned out.
Well, the diplomatic history of the U.S. Civil War, it seems to me, is one of the most important but least understood and perhaps even least studied aspects of this bloody conflict that led to the death of over 600,000 U.S. citizens, more than any other war this country has been involved in before or since. By way of comparison, the war in Vietnam had a death count of about 50,000, to give you some idea of the scope. Your question has a very important premise, which is that the so-called Confederate States of America, these states of the U.S. South that tried to break away from this country, not only break away but overthrow the U.S. government so that African slavery could be continued, they were counting upon the fact that not only Brazil but other nations in the international community would support their effort. They felt that Great Britain, which for reasons I've already alluded to, had various conflicts with the United States. After all, the United States had broken away from Great Britain in the war of the late 18th century. They had fought another war in 1812, and it's even though that's counted as a victory on this side of the Atlantic, in London there's a different kind of point of view, because from their point of view, they prevented the United States from seizing Canada, which, as they thought, was the main predicate for that war, from their point of view. And so many felt that Britain would like to see this powerful United States broken up, that is to say, having a successful secession effort. France, you might recall, basically during the time the United States was otherwise involved in the Civil War, had taken over Mexico. And, of course, this led to a lot of conflict in Mexico. But you had a lot of negotiations, as I talk about in the book, between leaders of Confederate States of America and the French occupation forces in Mexico City, because France felt that they could benefit from the United States breaking up. Indeed, some of these Confederate leaders had promised France that if the Confederate States of America had won this war, well, then France could retake California, which, of course, the United States had seized as a result of the war with Mexico in 1846 to 1848. And likewise, you had a lot of slave owners in Cuba and in Brazil who were in favor of the Confederate States of America succeeding, because they felt if the Confederate States of America did not succeed, this would call into doubt, call into question the future of slavery in Cuba and Brazil. And as it turns out, they were correct, because when the Confederate States of America basically failed in their effort to secede, this basically led directly, I would say, to the demise of slavery in both Brazil and Cuba. So as a result, during the U.S. Civil War, you saw ships in the Confederate States of America that found a friendly port in Rio de Janeiro, in Brazil. You saw these Confederate States of America ships basically acting as pirates, seizing U.S. ships. Keep in mind, this is the era before airplanes, for example. This is the era when most goods and humans are basically being transported by ship. And so this was a very important piece of warfare that was taking place, particularly in the South Atlantic, with the Confederate States of America being ably assisted by Brazil. I should also add the Confederate States of America was ably assisted by South Africa as well, another important nation of the South Atlantic. South Africa, as you know, had a system of racism that in some ways dwarfed the system of racism in the United States of America, culminating in the imposition of apartheid in 1948. But even before 1948, of course, you had a small European minority basically lording it over an African majority, and they also saw something in common with the Confederate States of America. And so you saw that in Cape Town, the major port in South Africa, many CSA, Confederate States of America, ships were in and out of Cape Town quite frequently. So the Civil War, in many ways, was a global conflict, although, of course, the main battleground was basically in the 11 states of the old Confederacy.
We're talking to Gerald Horn. Another interesting point that you make is both in the United States and in Brazil, the white elites were carefully watching slave rebellions in both countries to try to prevent their recurrence. How effective were they? And tell us about some of these slave rebellions that they were watching.
Well, the slave rebellion, of course, was the major defect of the system of African slavery. Both in Brazil and the United States, a wary eye was cast upon Haiti, which between 1791 and 1804 had the first and only successful slave rebellion in this hemisphere, leading to the development of a nation, Haiti, which went on not only to assist Simon Bolivar in terms of his liberation efforts in Venezuela and other parts of South America, but also Haiti went on to try to sponsor slave revolts of its own, both north and south of this country, which is now routinely described as the poorest nation in the Western Hemisphere. One of the lessons the slave owners drew from the slave revolt in Haiti was the lesson of ratios. That is to say that the African population had come to outnumber the European or slave-owning class by a huge number. And it was felt that this led directly to a slave revolt, and therefore this was one of the many reasons why you had such opposition to these U.S. nationals who were dragging Africans into Brazil. Keep in mind that Brazil, which is larger in territory than the United States, was colonized by a nation, Portugal, that has a contemporary population of about 9 million. The contemporary population of the United States is about, say, 300 million. And so there was a fear that this tiny European-derived population in Brazil could be overwhelmed as these U.S. nationals and their lust for profit kept dragging Africans across the Atlantic. And certainly, Brazil had many more slave revolts than the United States did. And when Brazil did have slave revolts, interestingly enough, they were studied, just like when U.S. had slave revolts, such as the Nat Turner Revolt, which is probably the bloodiest revolt of slavery that took in this country, that took place in Virginia approximately 170 years ago, when this religiously inspired leader, Nat Turner, led a band of individuals against slavery in Southampton, Virginia, massacring slave owners and their families, which, of course, sent more than a frisson of apprehension coursing down the spines of many slave owners in the South. And, of course, the Nat Turner Slave Rebellion, perhaps not surprisingly, led to a hardening of attitudes towards black people in this country, towards slavery, the proclamation that slavery was some sort of positive good, that it was actually helping the Africans, because it was taking heathens, to use that term that was used in the 19th century, it was taking heathens out of Africa and then supposedly giving them the benefit of Christianity. All these kinds of rationalizations were developing as a result of slave revolts, and you had a similar sort of rationalization that was taking place in Brazil at the same time. One of the things that I tried to suggest in this book is that slavery in this country is better understood as a hemispheric phenomenon. That is to say, just like today, many will be watching stock markets in Tokyo and in Hong Kong and in London in preparation for the opening of the stock markets on Wall Street. That is to say, you see capitalism as something of a transnational phenomenon, and one something that can happen in Tokyo can affect markets in New York. Well, there was something similar with regard to slavery, that the U.S. slavery was not an isolated institution. It was something that could be affected by trends in Cuba, in Brazil, in Africa, and of course in Europe as well.
We're talking to Professor Gerald Horn. I think it's really important to point out, in light of what you're saying, something which you brought up earlier, that when England abolished the slave trade, they had a strong interest in the United States not having a slave trade, not necessarily just because it was a humanitarian evil, but because if one country had a slave trade and the other didn't, the one who didn't couldn't compete economically against the other one.
Well, yes, yes. It's a lingering historical controversy as to why Britain was in the vanguard of slavery, of abolishing slavery, excuse me, and also why the abolition of the slave trade is being marked with so many conferences and symposia in the Great Britain, while you would never know that something like that is taking place, even though the United States was a major recipient of Africans, you don't have a similar sort of commemoration on this side of the Atlantic. Likewise, it's very curious that in this country, you don't have the kinds of museums devoted to slavery and the slave trade that perhaps an outsider might guess or think the United States would have, given, number one, how slave property was so important to this economy. In 1860, on the eve of the Civil War, property in slaves was probably the most important source of capital in this country, the most important economic institution in this country. Yet you don't have the kind of commemorations of slavery or anti-slavery in this country that you have in Great Britain. And it's a lingering question as to why. I think one reason is that on its shores, Britain did not have the kind of plantation slavery, nor the kind of sizable African-derived population that you have on these shores. And so, therefore, slavery and the slave system is a much more sensitive issue on this side of the Atlantic. Hello?
Yes, okay.
Sorry. Similarly, in Britain, when you had the abolition of slavery in the empire, you had a means, you had an opportunity to compensate some of the slave owners. In this country, when slavery was abolished in 1863-1865, basically slave owners went uncompensated. And that has been the source, I would suggest, of a good deal of anger that has continued to this very day. That is to say, you had rather affluent families in the South were basically wiped out by the Civil War, which has led, it seems to me, to a lingering resentment against the U.S. federal government, which basically led to that result, which basically led the effort to make sure that these slave owners were not compensated. I think the kind of anti-federal government sentiment that you have in this country, which has played such a role in current day politics in terms of perhaps explaining why you don't have a health care system of any note in this country.
What an interesting connection. I never would have known that.
Oh, yes. Or for example, the antagonism, the kind of resentment that you still have towards black Americans in this country. I mean, even though I think it's a mind-boggling scandal that black American men probably have the highest rate of incarceration of any group on this planet, it's in that 50% of the 2 million plus prisoners in U.S. prisons, which, by the way, is the highest rate of incarceration on this planet, 50% are black. And then, of course, the incarceration rate of black women is now skyrocketing. That a lot of this resentment, this sort of mundane, everyday resentment to black Americans, I think stems from the fact that these people were once property, and then that property was seized without compensation, just like if we seized your home, Mary Charlotte, without compensation, you might be somewhat resentful. And so this also leads to the larger point that we really haven't had a kind of reckoning, a kind of mass education or comprehension of what slavery has meant for this country. You basically went through you went into freedom, so-called, without any sort of understanding of what had happened before that. In South Africa, for example, after they abolished apartheid, you had the so-called truth and reconciliation process, whereby you had hearings where the victims and the victimizers gave testimony that was broadcast on national television, national radio. There was something of a cathartic process, and I think South Africa is the better for that. You didn't have that kind of process in this country, and so therefore it's like an adult that went through some sort of child molestation and never came to grips with that molestation, but feels that the passage of time has led to the disappearance of the ravages. Well, that's not true. You have to come to grips with that process, and we have not come to grips with the process of slavery, and I think the society is poor for that.
We're talking to Professor Gerald Horn. Let's turn to your second book, White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas After the Civil War. It starts with, and again, we're looking at the economic situation here, you talk about the Civil War in terms of the opportunity for competitors to the United States Confederacy in cotton and sugar markets in Fiji and Queensland, Australia. So in other words, they saw the Civil War as, oh, look, here's an opportunity for us to basically compete with the Confederacy, and this gave rise to more trafficking in human beings. Now the indigenous Pacific Islanders. Tell us that story. What happened?
Well, what happens is what the premise of your question suggests. That is to say, as the U.S. Civil War begins to unfold in the 1860s, obviously cotton markets and sugar markets are being handicapped because Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama are in the midst of a bloody conflict. So a number of merchants feel that these markets, which had been dominated to a degree by the United States or the southern states, that these markets could be challenged if you opened plantations in Fiji, which is in the South Seas, and Queensland, Australia. Queensland is on the northeastern coast of Australia. Australia is a country like Brazil whose territory is about the size of that of the United States. But unlike the United States, which has a population of 300 million, Brazil, a contemporary population of about 190 million, Australia has a contemporary population of about 21 million. And so because of this large territory and sparse population, it was felt that sprawling plantations were just the ticket for places like Queensland, Australia. The question, of course, arose as to where would the labor come from? That's the usual question that arises when you want to engage in plantation labor in the 19th century. And so the answer was that the labor would come from neighboring islands in the South Seas, comprised of indigenous Melanesians and Polynesians. The problem for this rather neat little trick, which, by the way, this slave system and the capturing of Melanesians and Polynesians and dragging them to Fiji, which is just east of Australia, and to Queensland, you had U.S. nationals from the South, from the states of the old Confederacy, who began to play, after a while, a leading role in this process, to the point where, as I describe in the book, you had a Ku Klux Klan chapter that opened in Fiji, the Ku Klux Klan, of course, being the terrorist group that arises in the South after the U.S. Civil War concludes in 1865, determined to deprive black Americans, in particular, of voting rights and the enjoyment of civil rights, and then in the 20th century, moves on to expand its jurisdiction towards anti-Catholicism and anti-Semitism and anti-immigration fervor as well that characterizes the Klan in the 20th century, in addition to, of course, its traditional anti-black attitudes. Well, the problem for this neat trick, as I've described it, of opening these plantations, these slave plantations in Fiji and in Queensland, Australia, was that you had an independent Hawaiian kingdom, which was rather modern. It was a modernizing agent in that part of the world. It modeled itself along the lines of a constitutional monarchy. In fact, it saw itself as something of a Great Britain of the Pacific. And in fact, if you look at the current Hawaiian state flag, it resembles the Union Jack. That is to say, all the way down to the flag, the Hawaiian kingdom was modeling itself after Great Britain. So the Hawaiian kingdom was basically moving to establish a confederation that would of South Sea Islands, which would prevent the kind of slave trading and depredations that were being inflicted upon these islands, not least by these former Confederate States of America nationals, of course, going to these islands, which, of course, many of which were rather tiny and microscopic, sometimes scooping up the entire adult population and taking them into slavery in Fiji and into Queensland, Australia. The problem for the Hawaiian Kingdom, of course, was that you had a number of U.S. nationals on their shores who were objecting to some of their maneuvers, not least what they saw as the Hawaiian Kingdom's trying to knock together this confederation, and also the Hawaiian Kingdom, in its search for an alternative labor source of its own, had moved in the 1880s to develop a relationship with Japan, to the point where today, in contemporary Hawaii, the plurality of the population in Hawaii is of Japanese origin because of this deal that was brokered between Honolulu and Tokyo in the 1880s to bring Japanese laborers across the Pacific to work on pineapple and sugar plantations in Hawaii. Many of the Euro-Americans in Hawaii were objecting to these maneuvers by the Hawaiian Kingdom, to the point where in 1893 they overthrew the Hawaiian Kingdom. But what they did not bargain for was that Tokyo objected to this overthrow, not least because in typical fashion these white Americans had mandated that only those of so-called pure European descent could have the right to vote, and obviously this excluded Japan. So you have Hawaii, which is one of the most isolated pieces of real estate on this small planet, about 2,200 miles west of San Francisco, for example, and then thousands of miles east of Australia. They were somewhat isolated in the Pacific and had developed this antagonist in Japan. So as the white leaders of Hawaii saw it, they had no alternative but to acquiesce to U.S. annexation, which, of course, takes place in 1898 when Hawaii becomes a territorial possession, so-called, of the United States of America. And then, of course, in 1959, the next big year in Hawaiian history takes place when it becomes the 50th and presumably final state of these United States of America.
We're talking to Gerald Horn. What was the perceived economic potential of the Pacific, and what were the various, I mean, you've already started talking about this, but what were the various imperial powers who were trying to get a piece of it?
Well, first of all, if you look at the map of this planet on which we reside, you'll see that the defining feature of this planet is the Pacific Ocean, this broad expanse of water that separates the United States from the most populous continent, which, of course, is Asia. Britain, of course, had already come to the conclusion that the key to global domination was Britannia ruling the waves, and that's why, historically, the Royal Navy has been one of the most important military institutions in the world, and, of course, was the guarantor for the British Empire and for British supremacy. The United States felt that in order to bring down Britain a peg or two, it had to dominate the Pacific, not least because, as the United States saw it, the existence of a Hawaii that was not friendly to the United States was a mortal danger, as the United States saw it, to U.S. national security. And as Washington saw it, its greatest fears were realized on December 7, 1941, when, of course, Pearl Harbor was bombed by the Japanese military. Germany also was a major player in this great game. That is to say, as Germany began to rise in the 1870s in particular, and as it looked around the planet, it saw that a good deal of the real estate already had been claimed by Great Britain in particular, but also, of course, by France, which had established a base in New Caledonia, which is this a small island off the coast of Australia, or in Tahiti, which is just south of Hawaii. And so Germany felt that its great power status was not mirrored by its control of colonial territory. So it was also beginning to rise as a power in that part of the world. And Australia, as a surrogate of London, of course, Australia was part of the British Empire, and as something of an independent player itself, which, of course, it's the major player right now in the South Seas, also was beginning to rise in prominence and eminence. And then, of course, there's Japan, of which since the United States' so-called black ships had sailed into Japan in 1853, a turning point in the history of Japan and, in fact, of the world, Japan had come to the conclusion that if it did not alter its domestic policies rather rapidly, it would fall victim to European colonialism, just like Hong Kong had fallen victim in 1841, 1842, or just like Africa had, for example, in centuries previous to that, which, of course, we just discussed a few moments ago in terms of the unlimited African slave trade. And so you have this amazing transformation that takes place in Japan from 1853 forward, and particularly after 1868 with the so-called Meiji Restoration, which basically marks the beginning of modernization in Japan, to the point where in two decades, say by the 1890s, Japan was already a major power to the point where it could challenge this white republic that was being established in the wake of the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom in 1893. So the Pacific was becoming a cockpit of global tensions. And this cockpit of global tensions, of course, led directly to the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom. One of the things that I point out in the book is that one of the presidential contenders, Barack Obama, is something of a product of this story that I'm telling, insofar as he was born in Hawaii in 1961, 2 years after Hawaiian statehood. And in his memoir, his popular memoir, Dreams of My Father, he talks about growing up in Honolulu and his grandfather, who of course is white and from Kansas, used to joke about how Barack was related to the Hawaii royal family. And of course, this is not true, but the point that I make here is that Barack, in some ways, does resemble a member of the Hawaiian royal family in terms of his skin color, his hair texture, etc. And this raises another point, which is that the Melanesians, who, of course, are darker than the Polynesians who populate Hawaii, resembled Africans. And because they resembled Africans, they were treated like Africans to the point where the N-word was used promiscuously to describe them, and to the point where it was felt that their fate should be the fate of slaves.
Gerald Horn, we have a world economy that that still is driven by commodities that slavery made possible, sugar, coffee, cotton, and many others. To what extent is today's world economy still driven by slave-level conditions, very poor working conditions, extremely low wages, if not outright slavery?
Well, how much time do you have?
About 5 minutes.
Okay. Well, first of all, slavery has not disappeared, even though I think it's fair to say that it has diminished greatly. That is to say that you still, in Europe, and to a degree in the Americas, have the trafficking in women. With the fall of the Berlin Wall in 1989 and the tumult that helped to engender in Eastern Europe, this has led directly to a rise in various forms of prostitution and trafficking of women that particularly, I would say, has afflicted London, but to a certain degree has also percolated to these shores as well. Similarly, you might recall the story from not so long ago from Los Angeles, where these Thai laborers from Thailand were basically locked into a factory that they were working in the Southern California region and had difficulty in escaping when a fire broke out. Now, these laborers, like I'm afraid too many undocumented laborers in this country, were treated like slaves. That is to say that their mobility was hampered. They either did not have passports or their passports were taken, which, of course, makes them very vulnerable in this country. Similarly, you will often read stories in your newspaper about cases in New York or in other places where you have diplomatic missions of foreign nations where foreign diplomats will bring a national from their country to basically serve as a domestic servant of some sort. And these people are basically treated no better than slaves. Oftentimes their passports are taken. Oftentimes they don't receive wages, or they receive next to nothing in terms of compensation. The problem is that slavery is highly profitable. And as long as profit is the North Star of a socioeconomic system, well, then the more unscrupulous amongst us will stoop to slavery. They'll find a means, mostly means that are foul, to enslave their fellow human being, and that is one of the many reasons why we are still afflicted with the curse of slavery.
The stories you tell highlight the cruelty and ruthlessness of this socioeconomic system, and that really seems to trump humanitarian concerns so blatantly. And I can't help but reflecting on our world economy. I mean, do you think there is any progress? I mean, slavery, as you say, is not as common as it used to be. But is there progress toward a humanitarian way of doing business compared to the 19th century, or not so much?
Well, first of all, keep in mind that one of the reasons that slavery began to diminish was because of people's movements. The abolitionist movement, one of the initial primary social reform movements on this small planet, arising not only on these shores, but also in Great Britain. Once again, I'd point you to the movie Amazing Grace, which just came out a few moments ago, or even the Steven Spielberg movie Amistad, which in some ways is a stirring tale about abolitionism. Similarly, today, we still have something of a thriving anti-slavery movement. Keep in mind that on the bulge of Africa, the area of Africa that sticks out into the Atlantic, particularly the area just north of Senegal in Mauritania, you still have forms of slavery, particularly slavery that afflicts the darker skins amongst us. And, of course, the slave owners basically being those of lighter skin. You've had the accusation has also been made with regard to the Sudan. The Sudan, of course, we all know because of the publicity that has been given this ongoing conflict in western Sudan and Darfur. But also in other parts of Sudan, you've had rather credible allegations made about slavery persisting. But likewise, you've had a thriving anti-slavery movement that has managed to put this institution under the glare of the international spotlight, and this has played a very significant and crucial role in terms of the retreat of slavery. So I would say that even within the confines of a socioeconomic system such as the one we have in this country and that exists all over the world, that takes as its guiding principle profit, there's still a possibility for energetic organizing by people's movements to put slavery, which is based upon the grossest form of human exploitation, to put slavery on the back foot and indeed drive it out of the international community altogether.
Gerald Horn, I want to thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you for inviting me. The pleasure has been all mine.
Gerald Horn is a prolific historian. He's a professor of history and African American studies at the University of Houston, and he is the author of many books, including the ones we just talked about today, The Deepest South, The United States, Brazil, and the African Slave Trade, and White Pacific, U.S. Imperialism and Black Slavery in the South Seas After the Civil War. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where this and many past interviews can be heard any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road, my name is Mary Charlotte. Don't forget to retune your radio dials to 101.1 FM. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.